Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Truth of Happiness Dhamma Study Sangha discussion on the five hindrances and Dhamma talk that introduces the 11th week study of the three refuges. This was recorded on February 28, 2017 at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So tonight we'll discuss the five hindrances and how that relates to developing an understanding of suffering and our individual contributions to that from craving and clinging. We'll start with Ram. Ram, good to see you tonight.
See you, everybody. The one that's still getting to me, or that I'm working on the most, is I think the sensuality part of the hindrances. I'll still occasionally get sideswiped with some ill will here and there. but I've always been, in the beginning when I first came here, the emphasis that the Buddha always gives to avoiding sensuality, kind of got to me. Coming from a Catholic background to begin with, it just rang a little bit too much like that.
Yeah.
And then, having the kind of hippie spirituality I was into later on, it was much more like have fun and be spiritual. So it took me a while to get to see what he was after there. I'm starting to see that he was just warning against it because it's such a strong force that'll get you off the Dhamma. It's really all pervasive, and it's very, it can be very overwhelming. It knocks you right off the path.
Yep.
And it's also getting clearer that this is the not self thing
that
comes up right away. Because I kept thinking, well, I don't like this, I like my sensuality. It's good. It's just another form of not self trying to establish itself.
That's the reason to be mindful of it.
Mm-hmm. And then getting into a bit into. Evolutionary psychology and finding out how much of this sensuality is just driven by what we need to do to procreate and keep our genes going in the gene pool. It's almost baked into us on a molecular level, which explains some of the strength that it has. All the things that we like are, there's a reason why we like it, because it drives us to spread those genes a little bit further, which is another good way of saying that that's not self.
Yeah. That's brilliant. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That what you just mentioned has driven many people to very unskillful and hurtful behavior, mm-hmm. Unrestrained anything that we justify simply because we feel like we want to do it, mm-hmm. and that's justification alone to go ahead and do it, is really the cause of all of the ills in the world. The talk tomorrow at lunchtime is on the Kalama Sutta, and that directly relates to this in a way. The Buddha's teaching a group called the Kalamas, who were questioning him on
We have all these different teachers coming through here. They lived on a trade route. And, how do we know? And we all claim that this is the one true Dhamma and you should follow me. How do we choose? And one of the things that the Buddha said, he said, you choose by the experiencing the efficiency of it. In other words, you first have to, if you want to compare the Buddha's teachings to these other teachings, you have to actually develop it so you know how to experience it. But then he cautions them that just because something makes you feel good is no reason to develop your life over it. But that was a common problem back then, and it's still a common problem. It's what distracts us. And there's so much... Again, I get myself in trouble when I say these things. There's such an emphasis in modern Buddhism that if it feels good, do it. And that's enough for Dhamma practice, that it then gives license for anything that follows from that. And in this way, these five hindrances speak directly to that. And it's so important to keep that in mind. And you explained it in a beautiful way. Thank you.
And I find I have to question myself. I say, okay, this feels good, or I want this. And I have to keep questioning myself, why? What is it that makes me want this?
And that points to the first two factors of the Eightfold Path, and most specifically to right intention.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we can be mindful of right intention, and right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, another maybe simpler way is to recognize eye-making. Am I following this desire because it contributes to more eye-making? If it does, you need to interrupt that. If you want to develop the Dhamma, nobody has to do this. But that really is the point. And of course, even these hindrances speak to and point to recognizing continued eye making. So, thank you, Stefan. Good to see you tonight.
Nice to see you also. No, I don't think I have anything to add. No,
well, I'm glad you're here. Good to see you tonight. Please say hello to Maeve for me. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. I didn't really read the chapter again for the five hindrances. I think it's a little silly of me to just say I just was meditating and didn't have many hindrances. I did have one, but for brevity, could you mind just telling me what they are again?
Well, the first one is a need for sensory stimulation or sensory distraction. Ill will is the second. Laziness, torpor.
Mm-hmm. All right. So,
doubt is part of skepticism, restlessness, and worry.
So, probably focused more on the first two. I think consistency of the practice is there, but I'm getting a little frustrated with, so I guess this would be some ill will sort of in there, about, sort of what I'm doing with this career, what I'm wasting my time doing, or if it's even wasting time, but it's not as if I'm just getting frustrated in some senses that things aren't the way I want them to be, and it takes me a little while to sit with that and be comfortable with that, but in time, I'm all right with that, but it's unnerving and makes me uneasy to have the knowledge, see things clearly enough, but yet I keep doing these things. Like, for instance, just going to this job. I'm doing it every day, but getting something out of it, I guess if you keep tracking the little bank over here, I'm getting paid to do this, but someone else is benefiting from what I'm doing, and I don't really feel that it's lining up with what I want to start to do, in the process of becoming. So it's something I need to sit with a lot, and it comes back to the first noble truth. There's dukkha, and things aren't the way it is. It's not gonna be perfect all the time. But I guess it's silly for me to sit here and just say that's causing me some stress, because other than this one little piece of my life, it's never been better. I've never been happier, and I'm pouring it into the cup every day. So I don't know if that makes any
It does. And, you know, it's pretty good that it's just this one little area of your life. And, you know,
pretty fortunate, right?
You are. But the living in the world can become more difficult the more we integrate the Eightfold Path as a framework for our life. But that's where an understanding of the First Noble Truth is and right view is so important. You know, so any engagement with the world is always going to be tinged by dukkha. No matter how wonderful your job may be, it's still included in the First Noble Truth that dukkha will occur there. And you said something that was, you know, so important, that you want it to be different. And of course, things can't be different than they are. Especially once they've occurred, you know. Or when we're involved in a system that is inherently rooted, or at least has some elements of craving and clinging. And so in a blanket statement, you could say, well, all commerce has that in it. And it does. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. It's just part of dukkha. It's part of living in the world. And we have to live in the world. There's always going to be circumstances that are disappointing. Again, the nature of dukkha. But our contributions to our own stress is when we want those things to be different than they are. They can't be. You know, and going the past 6 months of our political history is a perfect example of that. But on just daily mundane life is always an example of that. But we have to remember that there's an important aspect of livelihood. And I'm thinking of Anathapindika. If it wasn't for Anathapindika and other people engaged in commerce during the Buddha's time, the Buddha himself probably wouldn't have survived, and certainly all the monks and nuns that needed the support of the community. It's all part of that system. So we can take, here's what I'm trying to say, included in the dukkha of the world is the Eightfold Path of developing liberation from the dukkha of the world. In other words, we have to live in the world, but we don't have to be entangled in the world. And part of that is that we can go to work in an area where there might be some minor ethical problems, but that's simply recognized as part of the deal of being in the world. So thank you for bringing that up. And you are fortunate that it's just that one area of your life. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. For me, worry has always been almost like a badge of honor, I think being a mom and then, you know, just growing up afraid of certain things and what if and all of that. But I really haven't experienced any worry probably in the last, 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
And I have a daughter living out of the country right now, so I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, you are.
And I really just feel like the hindrances are the opposite of the path, so just getting on the path. And, you know, starting with right view, right intention, and
yeah,
going down the Eightfold Path, keeps you out of worry. I have a couple things going on right now that normally, at other times in my life, would be causing me a lot of worry. And instead, for me, a lot of this helps me slow things down and realize I don't need to respond to something right away or make a decision right away. Financial, my kid's car is in the shop, I have to decide what to do, but I've had a couple of good conversations with the place where it's at, so I just know we're going to figure it out, and I'm not worrying about it, and I'm not bringing it into my relationship with my husband or into my household, so it's been really wonderful. And really, like, since the summer, I had all sorts of worry going on with my work, things that were causing me stress. And, I sort of did two things. One was restraint of word, and the other thing was better preparation. And those things, also contribute to eliminating worry.
Yeah.
And things start to happen organically. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. And so I feel like I'm seeing things clearly, and it's all very good right now. I've enjoyed listening to a lot of what's been going on. Lorna, with all your bright, wonderful thoughts and how you explained karma and rebirth, that really affected me. Things that Jen has said or her mom has said, just really wonderful things coming out of the sangha. So it's been very helpful to me, even when I'm not here.
It's really been remarkable going through the book this time again. What you explained is what occurs from a practical integration of the Eightfold Path. You're still living in the world. I mean, you were describing it, but you're not reacting to it. And so if I could put some words in your mouth, if they're accurate, tell me. So you are mindful of your daughter's situation, but that mindfulness is not leading to a reaction, right, to worry. That's how it works.
It's outside of my control.
Yeah. But you're still, but you're mindful that there's a situation that the world can be a dangerous place,
right? Yeah,
and that's all it is.
Disregarding things, I still think about and care. And,
yeah.
Make sure I'm speaking to my one daughter, at least once a week. We actually talk to her more now that she's in Europe than when she was at Pitt. So this is all good. So it's really nice. It feels really good.
Yeah. I'll read the Karaniya Metta Sutta, like we close almost every class. But what precedes the teaching is that the Sangha at the time was very disturbed over two things that we're having. One was the attacks that were coming to the monks from other groups. And the other was fear of being of the animals and things that were occurring in the forest, meaning they had a lot of worry and a lot of resentment about what was occurring around them. And what the Buddha taught them was a way to let go of that ill will and to calm their minds and to be at peace with what was occurring. And he didn't get into, well, they're wrong and that's wrong and this is just what's occurring. Be at peace with it. So, thank you for that.
Thanks,
Maura, good to see you this evening.
Good to be here. I don't think I have much to say, although I have, it didn't read the thing on the hindrances. But I have been working around the hindrances. So when I asked Ram earlier tonight, how's your practice? And he mentioned the hindrances. And I was like, oh, because I've been looking at, well, what's like my hindrance? And just kind of, different ways of looking at it. So I happen to, lucky fortune that I am here tonight, and I've been contemplating the hindrances, not contemplating, working with the hindrances. And so I identified this week that maybe, it's like some of them, they pop up and they come and they go and whatever. but I would say the predominant one with me is probably restlessness. And that relates to anatta as well, it's just, it's this wanting, the self just wants to keep asserting itself, the ego identification wants to keep asserting itself. It doesn't, tonight when I was sitting in meditation, I was having that kind of, I felt very concentrated, and there's that fear when the self begins to come. Well, I have this experience that when that happens, there's like this feeling sometimes of so I think that's the self just not knowing, being frightened that it might not, the ego self, that it might not be able to keep asserting itself, that something is taking away. So I've been working, looking at restlessness, and I've been trying to really include all of just maintaining curiosity during my meditation towards all that's arising without analyzing it, just staying present with it. and that has kind of dissipated the restlessness. And maintaining a sense of, and I don't know, like there isn't maybe a formal term. Oh, yeah, it's kshanti. But patience or composure, kind of being with that all day long, like that's kind of been like my little silent mantra of like, to not comment on what's arising at all, any time, to just maintain like a stealthy, alert softness. And so that has kind of helped my that restless quality during the day, moving throughout the day, and in concentration practice. Mm. I guess I had more to say that.
Thank you. I'm glad you said it. See, when you look at the four hindrances that follow from sensory, the need for sensory stimulation, they really flow from that too. And restlessness is a good one. We become restless on our cushions or off our cushions because we're not getting enough distraction. There's not enough sensory stuff coming in to keep us distracted, and we become restless. And we want that. You know, that's the basic need for anatta, you know, to maintain itself, is constant distraction. Keep my mind away from what's really occurring, because if I don't, that feels like annihilation. Thank you, Laura. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. I think you called me on a very tired night, actually. How do you think tonight? I think my main problem is myself. You know, as you've mentioned, you have ego and anatta, and that's my main problem. You know, and I'm not always gentle with myself. As distractions in life, I get frustrated with myself because I don't always choose the eightfold path and be mindful. I don't do that. I like watching my screens. You know, so many bad habits, really. So I can get a bit I'll put it mildly, disappointed with myself, with my effort, and that kind of rolls on, and then you get distracted with that, and you can get in a bit of a pickle with that, really. That's all I have to say, really.
Thank you. I think you recognize, too, that disappointment with yourself is part of dukkha,
mm-hmm.
part of wanting me, wanting Lorna to
yes.
be different, you
yeah.
know. And that's the important thing,
yeah.
you know. Recognize that we're doing it to ourselves. There's nothing happening to us.
Yeah.
You know? As far as the quality of our mind, that's always up to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has nothing to do with what's occurring outside. To us, you know, we can always maintain that peaceful, calm mind through right view and right intention. I don't need to, Kevin started out tonight with, I don't need things to be different than they are, you know, whatever it is. Thank you, Liz. Good to see you tonight.
You too, John. I'm just wondering where fear does come in as a hindrance. Talking about not feeling like you're in the right place with your career or whatever, how much of that is based on, you know, the fear of knowing that you have to do something to support yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the fear, because of experiences through meditation practice, and Lauren and I talked about it one night, and John, you call it annihilation. I don't know if I'm having that fear of going back to that vast place that I was at in my meditation at one time, where I described it as feeling almost like like a type of senility because the thoughts did stop. And I haven't been back to that place since, and I wonder if it's such a deep fear for me. That's just something I guess I have to work through. It hasn't stopped me. My practice is better than it's been in a long time. I actually did a few skillful things today that got my anxiety down a little and was able to get on top of that. So anyway, just some things that I've been pondering. Sitting in meditation often, you know, the major distractions are things like, especially first thing in the morning is, okay, I'm going to sit here, but, you know, I have to do this, then I have to do that, and then I have to do this. And so it's just sort of calming all that down, realizing you're exactly where you need to be.
Something that can help that, just what you finished with, is just to remind yourself, this is what I'm doing now. I'm meditating. This is the time to meditate. That's
it. Makes everything else better.
Well, at least it can help focus on, this is what I'm doing. I don't need to be thinking about that. There's in 10 minutes I can address that. And that, it helped. The that fear arising in meditation, I gave a talk on this last week. I can't remember where, though, now. I think it was Thursday night. It's such a common thing that happens. If we're using the proper method, which we do, within the proper framework, it's going to take us to a place we've never been before. And as human beings, it's common to be afraid of that, even if it's just occurring with our own minds.
Mm-hmm.
It does often feel like annihilation, or it feels like I'm just losing myself here. There's no, you were talking about something that happened a while ago. The reason why it was so fearful is you had no frame of reference to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it feels like we're alone in the universe at times. That's the kind of fear that we, Moore was even touched on a little bit just now tonight. That's the kind of fear that all that we can do is to be gentle with ourselves and stay with it and just recognize it. It's an aspect of dukkha that we've created ourselves. And then there's the other type of fear. Again, we're using the same word to really describe two different things. There's a useful fear that helps us maintain our life. And I keep going back, I think I mentioned it even last week, that I was giving a talk on not self, and somebody asked this question because his understanding was that, well, there's no such thing of a self, and so there's nothing here to protect. And his question was, what if you're standing on a train tracks and a train is coming at you? Take two steps to the right. We don't lose our sensibility. We understand. And that even goes a little bit further. I mean, one of the things that the Buddha understood was the ineffectiveness and the distraction of taking on a practice such as severe asceticism, which he did. And why it's not helpful, because it's so hurtful to the physical body. There's nothing of any value in it. But as we develop the Dhamma, we learn that there's the opposite of that. This is where the Buddha came up with the middle way. The opposite of complete denial is complete sensory indulgence, which was also common at the time. There's still modern teachings, not teachings, they're philosophies, that the purpose of life is to get as much as you can. That saying that life is a banquet and you should never leave the table hungry, well, a reasonable thing is to take what you need and leave the rest. You know, that's the middle way. The same thing between... Yep. The same thing between that fear that can come in meditation, because it feels like we're losing everything when in fact we're losing nothing except we're letting go of views. So I may have gotten a little bit off your topic, but I hope not.
No.
Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Nice to see you too. Practicing and stepping back, trying to, that's something you said a few weeks ago to me, or I don't know, a couple months ago, the more you begin to practice, you really begin to see how distracted you are.
Yeah.
My thoughts are there and they're present, and some of them are very, I can't ignore them. So I'm just trying to be as present as I can and be responsible for how I knowledge and to do the best that I can.
Thank you for saying that. If we start ignoring what's occurring in our minds, that's just furthering ignorance. It's what's occurring. We have to be able to stay present and be mindful of what it is and recognize the parts of that that are continuing eye making and are rooted in ignorance and can only further that in our minds. So that's such an important thing that you recognize. There's times when this practice is just unsettling. It's just the way it is. But what it brings us to, and it's really the opposite of annihilation, a fully awakened, fully mature human being is at peace with everything that occurs and appreciates everything that occurs. Why? Because it's simply what's occurred. And because there's no me needing, meaning I don't need things to be different than they are, I can actually be present with things that in the past would have proven to be unpleasant or I might have created an aversion to. And we also understand impermanence, that no matter what's occurring, it's not going to last. You know? That also helps protect our keep our Dhamma practice focused, because as we deepen our concentration and recognize the problem of attachment and clinging and entanglements, it helps keep our Dhamma practice very simple and very well focused too. We don't start attaching ourselves to different things and different ideas, and because they make us feel good or everybody else, this is again going back to the talk I'm giving tomorrow, maybe that's why I'm thinking about it so much. But it doesn't compel us to start embellishing our practice with other things, you know, just because they feel good or sound good or look good. It allows us to keep well focused, which is really what, again, why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, to help us do that. He understood our natural tendencies through conditioned thinking to want to create something else out of what's occurring, rather than simply be present, you know, and develop that deep concentration or refined mindfulness. So a great discussion on the five hindrances. And again, they're just there to keep us well focused on the Dhamma. So I'll conclude our Dhamma study with the Ratana Sutta. There's a chapter in the book before that called on Precepts and Paramitas. The reason why I'm skipping over it is because I talk about that, and I think I've just given a talk on that recently. And really, the Ratana Sutta taking refuge in the Dhamma is what we've done the last 10, 11, or 12 weeks, you know. This is what it means to take refuge in the Dhamma, to actually develop the Dhamma. It's not some conceptual thing where, well, you know, the Buddha's teachings and I'm going to wrap myself in the Buddha's teachings. Taking refuge in the Dhamma means that we actually develop the Dhamma. Taking refuge in the Sangha means that we actually have a well-focused Sangha that is a true refuge. And taking refuge in the Buddha means to understand that a human being did just what we're trying to do. And not to embellish that. You know, it's important to not elevate the Buddha from being a human being, an outstanding human being, but to elevate him to some godlike status. Because what that does is that creates grasping in our own minds. Now I have to develop something that only a god is able to do. Well, the Buddha was very clear that he's just like the rest of us. In fact, he said that so often, it became commonplace. Basically said, I'm just like you, but I'm the guy that figured it out first. So, and then he said, Epasiko, try it for yourself. So let me read the article. You're going to read it this week anyway. But nearly all schools of Buddhism refer to the three jewels and taking refuge in them. The three jewels are also called the three refuges, which is really a better term for them. Refuge is a place or state of mind that is a protection or a shelter from hardship or danger. Refuge is a place or state of mind that is a source of comfort and peace. The three jewels are the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. In Buddhism, when one takes refuge, one is taking refuge in these precious jewels. The ritual of taking refuge is a formal and usually public statement of holding the strong intention to have the example of the Buddha and the teachings of the Dhamma be the framework for awakening, along with supporting and receiving the support of a community of Dhamma practitioners or the Sangha. It is a beautiful. I took refuge up at a monastery called Dhammacakka. Oh, I can't remember the name of it. Do you remember the name of that?
KTD.
Yeah, so. Karmatriyama Dhammacakka. Beautiful place in Woodstock, New York, on top of Meads Mountain. It was a three-day ceremony. It was just beautiful, culminating in this, in the ceremony of formally taking refuge, which really, there's a lot more involved in that tradition. But really what it means is I'm starting to turn my mind to these refuges and understand that they are true refuges in the world of dukkha. Again, that's the whole point. Everything the Buddha taught, including this, is in relation to that. And when I get into the story of the Ratana Sutta, you'll see how that fits. The teaching known as the Jewel Discourse, or the Ratana Sutta, was given in the city of Visali at a time of widespread famine and spreading disease. There were many dead bodies as the conditions overwhelmed the ability to properly dispose of bodies. The local citizens sought out the Buddha's help, who was nearby in Rajagaha. The Buddha arrived in Visali a short time later with a large number of monks, including Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and his second. Just before the Buddha's arrival, torrential rains helped the situation somewhat by cleansing the landscape of rotting corpses and clearing the air and water. Pretty difficult place where the Buddha found himself and the other people, wasn't it? So this is important here. The Buddha presented this teaching to an entire city overcome by physical and emotional suffering. Prior to his presenting this discourse, he instructed his attending monks to walk through the city and do what they could to ease the physical suffering of the citizens and to individually present this teaching. The reason why that's significant is the Buddha didn't just come in and disregard the actual suffering that the whole town was in and say, you know, all you got to do is meditate and take to the Dhamma, you'll be fine. The first thing we, and this points to what we need to do, we need to take care of our physical needs as well as develop the Dhamma. It doesn't, it's an act of ignorance to think that we can take to the Dhamma and ignore our own humanity. In fact, the Buddha taught just the opposite of that. And this is just a good example of this. At the formal teaching, the Buddha then presented a way to bring true refuge from the stress and suffering of the world and to put an end to all dukkha. These are the Buddha's words. May all beings assembled have peace of mind. The first thing he addressed is the culmination of his path, isn't it? May all beings assembled have peace of mind. May all beings assembled listen mindfully to these words. May you all radiate goodwill and loving kindness to all who offer help and understanding to you. Understand this, there is no more precious jewel, no more precious refuge, no more comfort than the Buddha. So again, the Buddha's not saying him by holding himself up as a god, he's holding himself as an example of how we can develop true refuge like another human being has done. I'm going to read that again. There is no more precious jewel, no more refuge, no more comfort than the Buddha. As woodland groves in the early heat of summer are crowned with blossoming flowers, so is the sublime Dhamma leading to the calm and peace of Nirvana. The peerless and excellent awakened one, the teacher of true understanding, the teacher of the noble path, is the Buddha, the one who has awakened. Those are beautiful words. It's Thanissara Bhikkhu's translation. Here the Buddha is not, these are my words, here the Buddha is not teaching worship of himself. The Buddha often referred to himself as the Tathagata, the one who has gone forth, meaning the one who's the first one who did this, who developed this understanding. The Buddha had gone forth from distraction and ignorance, stress and suffering to well-concentrated wisdom. He liberated himself from clinging to all objects and views. Through his own efforts, Siddhartha Gautama awakened to become a Buddha. The Buddha is here offering himself as the example of one going forth, leaving the world behind. In some ways, a physical leaving the world behind, but more accurately, in a figurative sense, meaning no longer attached to the world. Taking refuge in the Buddha is understanding that all human beings can go forth from ignorance and attain wisdom and right understanding. There is great protection and comfort in understanding that liberation and freedom is possible for all human beings. The Buddha continues, there is no more excuse me. There is no more precious jewel than the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma. Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The Buddha, calm and mindful, has experienced the cessation of clinging and desire. The deathless state of nirvana has been attained. And what that last line means is not that you are now going to live physically forever. Even the Buddha showed that that's not what the goal of this is. The deathless state refers to once awakened, you are now no longer going to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance and prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. That's the deathless state that we're referring to in Buddhism. It's not some magical state where you'll live forever. Again, the Buddha died at 80. The Buddha teaches the Noble Eightfold Path that unfailingly brings concentration, liberation, and freedom. There is no more precious jewel than the Dhamma. My words now. The Buddha is describing that there is a precious jewel in taking refuge in the path of liberation and freedom. In this setting in Visali, the Buddha is teaching that once practical needs have been taken care of, to turn one's attention to being mindful of the teachings of the Buddha. Again, he's also emphasizing that the refuge is in his teachings, not in something outside of his teachings. The Buddha continues, there is no more precious jewel than the Sangha. And we know that here, don't we? Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The virtuous ones who bring the Dhamma, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those with steadfast minds, free of clinging, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those that understand with wisdom the Four Noble Truths, they are the jewel of the Sangha. So we've all developed to become the jewel of our own Sangha, haven't we? Those that gain true insight and abandon self-delusion, doubt, and indulgence in meaningless rites and rituals, they are the jewel of the Sangha. So even back then, the Buddha is cautioning against bringing other practices in. There were a lot of other rituals that people were very fond of back then. Those beyond despair and evil doings, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those whose understanding arises from the support of the Sangha, and of course that's every one of us, isn't it? Those whose understanding arises from the support of the Sangha, who can no longer conceal the truth from themselves due to the Sangha, they are the precious jewel of the Sangha. Those whose karma is extinguished, the future of no concern, with rebirth ending due to the support of the Sangha, this is the precious jewel of the Sangha. The end of the Buddha's words. The example of the Buddha's life, the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma, along with the support of the Sangha, provides refuge from the suffering of distraction and ignorance arising from dukkha. Being mindful of the three jewels concentrates the mind to what is of utmost importance. Taking refuge in the three jewels is taking great comfort in understanding that awakening is possible for any human being. The example of the Buddha's life shows just that. There is great comfort in realizing that the way of liberation is a path accessible and integrated by anyone, the Eightfold Path. There is also great comfort in knowing that we do not engage in the path of liberation and freedom alone. The Buddha often said that the most important aspect of practice is the Sangha. The support and commitment that we gain from each other often provides the encouragement and strength to continue, even when difficult times interfere. Holding in mind the three jewels provides continual direction for one's mindfulness. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha also provides a framework for mindful expression of joy and freedom. So that's the end of the article, which I hope you'll all read. We'll discuss this a little bit next week, but I think I'm going to go back to teaching at a sutta, and if I have it done, I'm going to be teaching on something called the Brahma Vihara, if I'm remembering the word correctly, which is a rather long sutta, but it's a sutta on how confused views can arise and how to keep well focused. Tomorrow's talk is going to be on the Kalama Sutta, and it directly relates to this in the way that, and I touched on this a little bit earlier. One of the common misunderstandings, and I think probably the major reason why there's been so many adaptations to the original Buddha's teachings, is this notion that the Buddha said that we should question everything, and with the implication that what we question and we don't like, we can adapt it or throw it out. The Buddha said, again, the Buddha taught everything in the context of the Four Noble Truths, and when he used those words, especially in the Kalama Sutta but other places, he was saying, you first have to develop the Dhamma before you can know if it's effective. So obviously you have to develop just the Dhamma. And then you can weigh the benefits of that over other things that you may have learned or are thinking of developing. And then as far as questioning everything, the Buddha said that quite often throughout his teaching career, and probably most significantly in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is a sutta recounting the last approximate 90 days of the Buddha's life. And what he was saying, that while I'm here, and you have a misunderstanding of what I'm saying, or it's not clear, you're confused, question me directly. And that's all he meant by question everything that I say. If you have a problem with it, here I am. Ask me the question. Now, of course, we can't do that anymore, can we? He's been gone 2,600 years. But we are so fortunate that from the first Buddhist council, the teachings of the Buddha have been preserved in their original pure form. And so how do we question the Buddha? The only way we can do that now is to look to his record. But again, the Buddha wasn't saying, question it, question my Dhamma. If you don't like it, put something else in its place. That would be foolish, wouldn't it? That this man spent 45 years of his life teaching something, and he said, you can just dismiss it offhand. Doesn't make any sense, does it? But we can question when we're confused, when we're doubtful. We can go to the Dhamma and question it, can't we? The record is still here. And that's what that means, and that's what the talk will be on tomorrow. So it'll be recorded, too, if you want to listen to that talk.
Where are you talking tomorrow?
It's just on that online, Wednesday online Dhamma talk.
In the afternoon.
Yep. It's 12 o'clock that I give that talk, but it's also recorded, so you can listen to it. I don't know if you've noticed it on my website. Everything now is on YouTube. All my video recordings are on YouTube, but they're also accessible directly from my website, too. And all these talks, too, are they're on my podcast. Liz?
Just with your talk tonight and the sutta, the story of the sutta, when I was here on Saturday, there was a gal talking about how they must have just had a lot of time to sit and contemplate during the Buddhist days. And I'm thinking, yeah, when corpses are like rotting off the side of the hill, and they have to like search for food, and then they're worried about the animals in the forest. Yeah, they had a lot of time to sit and contemplate. Yeah. I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, they were quite busy. I guess we have this idyllic view that all that they did was they sat under trees all day long and meditated, but that's far from the truth. You know, they had their own community to take care of. They had to go into town every day and get food and all the rest of the things. That was Stacy, wasn't it? The young girl
that
came.
Yeah, she was sitting in front of me. I don't remember what her name was, but I think I just had a really good sense of how she's looking at things, that she's going to make progress.
Oh yeah,
because she just has a real, she doesn't know it necessarily yet, but she has a real sensibility about it. I think she's going to do really well.
Yeah, you could see the word is chanda, skillful desire in her.
Yeah.
And she also said that she doesn't have, she's young too, I don't know how much influence she could have had, but she doesn't have a lot of influence by a lot of other teachings. She's coming here with, fortunately, a rather pure mind. It really makes it much easier. But, you know, we all come here with what we have, and we all have to deal with it. So, okay. Any questions about what we talked about tonight? No? Good? Okay. We'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on metta, as we always do. I did have an announcement, but I can't remember what it was. So. If it's important, I'll put it in the newsletter. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. And metta is both the aspiration of those of us developing the Eightfold Path and the expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. The Buddha's words. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is no longer born into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.